Morning. Delighted to welcome some special guests with us today. We have Lincoln High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming with us today. You may be seated. And we have guests from the Women's Court and Civic Conference. Would they please stand? They may be seated too. Thank you for coming. Is Mrs. Gableman in this group? Would she stand, please? You're a very special guest. For those who don't understand it, I'm told she's the mother of Michael Gableman. Is that right? Michael Joseph Gableman. I have to
You have been reliably informed, Chief.
Take it on information and believe. Thank you. Thank you for coming, all of the Women's Court and Civic Conference. And as I said in the earlier proceeding, we haven't seen the Civic Conference for many years. And so we're delighted to have you back with us. The Lincoln High School students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. High school students across the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, the students are sent material about the case and may engage in some activities relating to the case. They come to oral argument, and then after the second oral argument, that is after this oral argument, the students and anyone else here invited to join with a justice, and the discussion will be on the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case we are about to hear. So you're all invited to join that discussion. Now, it's a bit easier to listen to an oral argument and understand it if you're familiar with the facts and the legal issues presented. So we have prepared a synopsis of this particular case. If anyone in the audience would like a copy of that synopsis, if you raise your hand, the marshal will give you a copy. So we do have several hands raised. Raise it high so she can see it. Go ahead. She being the marshal.
The deputies.
And the deputies.
Deputies.
Oh, good. Our deputy marshal is also doing that. While these synopses are being distributed, let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler, and you will be meeting with Justice Ziegler today. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left, Justice Patience Rogensack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call the second case, 08AP519. Baldwin Woodville Area School District versus West Central Education Association, arguing on behalf of the West Central Education Association is Gina Jonan. Counsel, you may proceed. Before you proceed, Ms. Jonan, I gather that the party in issue is the West Central Education Association, right? Is WEAC a party?
The WEAC is not a party. They are an affiliate of ours.
I know. And you are a you are counsel, and counsel is being provided by WEAC.
That's correct.
The reason I ask all these questions is because of my recent successful campaign and the various endorsements and financial contributions, and wanted to be sure that no party, that is WEAC, is not a party.
That's correct.
Okay. In light of that, if you want to know what the contributions are on both sides and the endorsements, you can check the official records. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you. May it please the court. I am Gina Jonan, appearing on behalf of the petitioner, West Central Education Association, Baldwin Woodville Unit. Seated to my right is Ms. Christine Johnson, the teacher involved in this case. On its surface, this case involves whether the arbitrator rendered a perverse misconstruction of the collective bargaining agreement when he determined that the association's grievance regarding Ms. Johnson's back pay was timely. But this case will ultimately determine the more fundamental issue of whether arbitration remains a viable alternative to court litigation. I will address three reasons why the Court of Appeals erred in vacating the arbitration award. First, the Court of Appeals erroneously expanded the perverse misconstruction standard when it vacated the arbitrator's decision because it made its own independent finding of when the grievance occurred. Second, the parties received what they bargained for because the arbitrator analyzed timeliness in accordance with arbitration principles. Third, if allowed to stand, the Court of Appeals' opinion will severely undermine the cost-effectiveness and efficiency of arbitration, contrary to the strong legislative policy favoring arbitration as the means to resolve disputes, especially in labor relations. I respectfully request that the Court reverse the Court of Appeals and affirm the Circuit Court's decision to confirm the award.
Counselor, did the arbitration agreement give the arbitrator the authority to determine timeliness of a grievance?
Yes, it did, Your Honor. The district submitted two issues to the arbitrator. The first issue was whether or not the grievance was timely. The arbitrator decided timeliness in accordance with that issue submitted. Judicial review of arbitration awards is extremely limited. The court's role is a supervisory one, and the goal being to merely ensure that the parties receive what they bargain for. The court starts with the presumption that the arbitration award is valid, and it can only be vacated when the party seeking to vacate it proves it is not valid by clear and convincing evidence. While this court has vacated arbitration awards when an arbitrator exceeds their powers by rendering a perverse misconstruction, this court instructed in the City of Oshkosh case that an arbitrator does not create a perverse misconstruction when his or her interpretation of the contract is founded within reason. Here, the arbitrator's decision was founded within reason. The arbitrator looked at all the facts, heard the witnesses testify, looked at the evidence, and determined that the complaint upon which the grievance was based was the board's denial of Ms. Johnson's back pay in June 2006.
Ms. Jonan, if I might, let me interrupt you for a minute. We got a case that was decided relatively recently, maybe within the last year or so, the Racine County case, which had to do with arbitration. Do you think that that's at all applicable in this particular situation?
No, it is not, Your Honor. Racine County was not a perverse misconstruction case. In that case, the court vacated the award because it conflicted with statutory and constitutional provisions. It did not vacate on a perverse misconstruction standard.
Thank you.
At issue in this case was the interpretation of the contractual language of when the facts giving rise to the grievance first occurred or first became known. That phrase is ambiguous, subject to interpretation. The arbitrator determined that when the facts giving rise to the grievance first occurred or first became known was June 2006. In his authority to do so, he did not disregard the plain contractual language because he took the 15-day timeline language in the contract, applied that language to the event he determined triggered the grievance. He also stated that because the district was seeking to show the grievance was untimely, it had the burden of proof. And because the date of the board hearing was not in the record, the district didn't prove that the union filed its grievance more than 15 days after the board voted to deny the back pay. Thus, he took the contractual language of 15 days and applied that language to the event triggering the grievance. Where the Court of Appeals erred in this case is the court looked at the award and determined on its own that the grievance occurred in May 2006 when the union and Ms. Johnson went to talk to the district administrator about the back pay. The grievance documents show that Ms. Johnson thought the fact that she had not received the back pay was an administrative error that the district could readily correct. The critical point is that the district administrator in May 2006 declined to act. He thought he did not have the authority to make the requested payment, so he deferred that decision to the board. The board voted to deny the back pay in June, and the union timely filed its grievance. Prior to that time, Ms. Johnson didn't have a decision from the board regarding her back pay, so there wouldn't have been any grievance when she talked to the district administrator in May 2006. The arbitrator's decision is founded upon reason, because it discourages parties from filing grievances before they even know if they have a dispute. So his interpretation under labor law principles is founded within a reason. Where the Court of Appeals erred is that it really stepped into the shoes of the arbitrator and made its own finding of when the grievance occurred. By doing so, it erroneously expanded the perverse misconstruction standard, because this court has long instructed that even if a court disagrees with the arbitrator's interpretation or thinks another interpretation is more reasonable, that that is not a proper basis upon which to vacate an award. Even if the court thought the arbitrator made a mistake of fact or even one of law, the court should not vacate the award. It is only when it rises to the level of a perverse misconstruction.
What should it rise to the level of perverse misconstruction if it exceeds its authority?
Yes, Your Honor, but this court instructed in the city of Oshkosh that an arbitrator only exceeds their authority when their opinion has no foundation in reason.
So it's unlike other areas of law, I take in my mind, like workers' compensation, where there's a standard of review much the same. If they are in excess of their authority, then the underlying award or decision can be reversed. And it defines excessive authority if they misconstrue an important fact or misconstrue the law. That sort of definition doesn't apply here in this kind of a case in defining when you act in excess of your authority.
That's correct. Even if the court thought the arbitrator made a mistake of fact or of law, the arbitrator is within his or her authority to do so, and the court will not vacate under those circumstances.
But if it's a really big mistake of law?
Even if it's a really big mistake of law, the court will not vacate because the parties bargained for an arbitrator to determine the grievance, not a court.
And so it's contrary to state statute?
If the award itself is contrary to state statute, then the court will vacate an award, as it did in Racine. But if the arbitrator, in interpreting the contract, makes a mistake of law, then the court will not vacate under those circumstances. It is only when it rises to the level of perverse misconstruction. And this court instructed in the City of Oshkosh case that in other cases where the court has vacated under a perverse misconstruction standard, it has done so because the award conflicted with statutes that were explicitly referenced in the collective bargaining agreement. But here, there were no statutes or constitutional provisions at issue. So what the Court of Appeals really did is it looked at the arbitrator's decision and it disagreed with his interpretation of the contract. It substituted its own interpretation and vacated the award. By doing so, it expanded the definition of perverse misconstruction, contrary to the long line of cases where this court has instructed it should not do so in those cases.
How much is involved here? This is a back pay.
Yes, Your Honor. The exact amount is not in the record, but given the difference, it is about $1,800. And this case is precisely why we need to have final and binding arbitration. Parties agree to arbitration in order to avoid the time and expense of civil litigation. They also do so in order to have their disputes decided by mutually agreeable experts in their field. When they agree to arbitration, they know that they are trading certain procedural safeguards, such as appellate review, in order to have their cases decided less expensively, more informally, and more efficiently. Here, given the minimal amounts at issue, the parties proceeded to arbitration, where the state charged the parties $250 each to have an arbitrator decide the case. They had a decision within 7 months. Because of the district's resort to court action, it has been nearly 3 years and tens of thousands of dollars later, and the parties are still awaiting final resolution of the case. I think what's telling here is the district is before this court really making the exact same arguments it made to the arbitrator and lost. The district is really trying to relitigate its case on the merits. Because the court of
appeals... John, let me interrupt you at this point, if I might. What was the reasoning of the arbitrator in arriving at his decision on timeliness? How did he analyze the contract to arrive, the CBA, to arrive at his decision?
The contract language says that a grievance must be filed within 15 days upon which the facts giving rise to the grievance first occur or first become known. The arbitrator determined that in June 2006, when the board voted to deny the back pay, that was the association's grievance, because prior to that time, there had been no decision made regarding her back pay. So the arbitrator determined that June 2006 was the critical event when the board voted for the denial. The association filed its grievance within 15 days of that date, or at least the district didn't prove otherwise. And the reason that event was the critical date was because when the parties met in May 2006 to discuss the issue, the district administrator declined to act and instead deferred that decision to the board. So it wasn't until the board voted that the parties knew their position regarding back pay. So it had its foundation in reason, especially under labor law, because we don't want unions to have to file grievances before we even know what the employer's position is. And so the arbitrator's decision was also in accord with the contract that says the parties should make an earnest effort to resolve disputes informally first. And that's exactly what the parties did here. Ms. Johnson thought that it was an administrative error when she realized she hadn't gotten the back pay. She went to talk to the district administrator. He felt he didn't have the authority to act, and so he deferred that decision to the board. When the board voted and told the union, no, we're not going to provide the back pay, then the union timely filed its grievance. And that's the way it frequently works in labor cases. So the arbitrator's decision had a foundation in reason, because the union doesn't have to file a grievance until it knows it has a dispute.
Well, the Court of Appeals said, however, an arbitrator has no authority to disregard or modify an agreement's plain or unambiguous terms. We conclude the arbitrator's construction of the 15-day time limit for filing grievances was a perverse misconstruction because it was contrary to the collective bargaining agreement's plain and unambiguous terms. Is that the law of the land?
It is correct that it can be a perverse misconstruction if the arbitrator ignores the plain language in the contract, but the arbitrator did not do so in this case because the language, when the facts giving rise to the grievance first occur, is ambiguous. That is subject to interpretation. The union argued that its grievance was about the board denying the back pay. The arbitrator was within his authority to interpret that ambiguous language. It then did not ignore the plain language, which talks about the 15-day time limit. It merely applied that 15-day time limit to the board's vote of denying the back pay. So what the Court of Appeals did, really, is it looked at the arbitrator's decision and said, no, we don't agree that it started in June, we say it started in May. And by doing so, the Court of Appeals erred, because this court has instructed that even if a court thinks its own interpretation is better or more reasonable, that's not a proper basis upon which to vacate an award. The arbitrator doesn't have to even have the most reasonable construction of the contract. His interpretation just has to have a foundation in reason. And here, his interpretation did so. Which leads me to my second point, that the parties received what they bargained for when the arbitrator interpreted timeliness based on arbitration principles. When parties agree to arbitration, they do so with the understanding that it is a fundamental arbitration principle that arbitrators should construe timeliness provisions in favor of resolving a case on the merits. This is sound public policy because it encourages parties who have disputes to be able to resume working together free of controversy. Because when the parties have a dispute over contract language to the level where they need an arbitrator to resolve that dispute, If the arbitrator dismisses on something such as timeliness, then the parties never get a true resolution to their dispute, and that dispute is allowed to fester until maybe the next case when the contract is interpreted. So when the district agreed to arbitration here, it knew that the arbitrator would apply this arbitration principle of trying to resolve timeliness disputes in favor of resolving the case on the merits. So the district shouldn't have been surprised in receiving the opinion that it did. What happened is the Court of Appeals stripped the parties of the benefit of that bargain to have a case decided based on arbitration principles when it made its own finding. And that is why the federal courts say that procedural arbitrability questions should be allowed to be decided by the arbitrator, not the courts, because it's different than a statute of limitations analysis where the court can't expand a statute by judicial construction. In arbitration, arbitrators try to resolve cases on the merits so that the parties who have to continue working together can do so free of controversy. And that leads me to my third point, what the Chief Justice has also touched upon, that because the district is here trying to relitigate its case on the merits, it's taken what has been a very minimal dispute and made it very costly for the parties to have to litigate this case in court. We're in the Supreme Court based on a dispute that is over about $1,800. And as the Seventh Circuit recently instructed in the Clear Channel case, that is precisely the type of argument that we're trying to avoid here, is that parties should not be encouraged to continue to argue with their cases on the merits. If the court overturns the Court of Appeals decision here, it will be making a very strong statement that we need to preserve arbitration as a more cost-efficient means, a less expensive means, of deciding labor disputes. This is a decision in arbitration that parties receive all the time. Parties often have timeliness disputes. And if the court encourages parties to take their case to the court, knowing that they might get a more favorable opinion from a court when they don't like the arbitrator's case, that will just encourage appeals as a matter of course. And what will happen is that arbitration won't be final and binding because parties, when they don't like what the arbitrator says, will want to appeal the case to the court in the hope of getting a second or even a third more favorable opinion. And that will only increase the cost to the taxpayers, unduly prolong contractual disputes, and clog the court system. And the legislature drafted Section 78810 precisely to avoid that result. Wisconsin has a strong legislative policy favoring arbitration as the means to resolve labor disputes. That policy is so strong that under the Municipal Employment Relations Act, it is illegal for a party to refuse to comply with an arbitration award. It is only by affirming the circuit court's decision that the court will honor this strong legislative policy of deferring to arbitration awards.
Ms. Jonan, isn't there also a strong policy against the processing of stale claims? And couldn't the arbitrator's interpretation here be construed as allowing the processing of stale claims?
I have two responses to that. First, the claim was not stale because the board voted in June 2006 to deny the back pay.
Well, I understand that's your position, but couldn't an interpretation be that it occurred when the administration refused to rectify the error?
It could, but I would argue that's a decision for the arbitrator to make. And so the arbitrator determined that it started in June 2006. So even if May 2006 is a reasonable interpretation, and I argue that it isn't, but even if it is, then it was not the rule. The court doesn't affirm the most reasonable interpretation. The court has to affirm the arbitrator's interpretation if his or her interpretation had a foundation upon a reason. So it doesn't have to be the most reasonable interpretation. It just has to have a foundation in reason. And here it did so because while we do have a policy against stale claims, in arbitration, it is more important to try to resolve a case on the merits and construe something as timely.
For the policy reasons that you've already discussed.
Exactly. Because in labor relations, we don't want to encourage parties to file grievances before they even know that they have a dispute. And that is why the arbitrator's decision here is founded upon a reason, because it wasn't until the board said, we're not going to give you the back pay, that the union then had to file a grievance. Prior to that time, the parties were still trying to work it out informally, and the district administrator had declined to act. So he deferred the decision to the board made the decision, the union filed the grievance.
is there something unreasonable about the district's interpretation of the facts?
The district's interpretation is unreasonable because the arbitrator made the finding that prior to June 2006, the union didn't know the district's position regarding back pay. And the district is now trying to say, well, at least they knew it in May 2006. But the record shows that wasn't the case, because if the district had already denied the back pay request, when the parties met with the district administrator in May, the district administrator would have merely reiterated that decision. District administrator would have said, no, we told you we've denied it, or we're denying it now. But he didn't say that. He said he did not have the authority to make the requested payment. So he took the decision to the board. The board could have said, we will grant you the back pay, in which case there would be no grievance. The board didn't. It said, we're not going to grant you the back pay. So then the union filed a grievance. Under the district's interpretation, it would tell unions that they have to file grievances before they even know what the employer's position is. And that's not sound policy in labor relations. You know, many times employers don't like it when the union files a grievance, so the union doesn't want to file a grievance until it knows the employer's position and knows that it has a dispute. In conclusion, the court has accepted review to determine whether the...
Before you do the conclusion, mm-hmm. I'm going to go back to a question that Justice Crooks raised with you about the recent Racine case that we had, the Racine County case. In your petition for review, you indicated that the reason we ought to take review is that Court of Appeals decisions are interpreting the Racine County case too broadly to allow reinterpretation of the arbitrator's award. Can you expound on that?
Certainly, Your Honor. Arbitration appeals are very rare. And after the court decided the Racine County case, which I submit was on very narrow principles, a very unique case that addressed constitutional provisions, which we don't have here, that after that point, we received two Court of Appeals decisions that vacated arbitration awards and received another case where a party was appealing an arbitrator's award. So the concern was that the Court of Appeals were taking the Racine County case and really expanding the holding as a reason for vacating awards. So we asked the court to take the case to instruct that Racine was a very unique circumstance. It didn't alter the judicial standards of whether when awards can be vacated.
And it's unique because of its constitutional basis?
Yes.
Why is Racine County unique, in other words?
Because that case involved the constitutional provisions regarding the court appointment of family court social workers. And so it'll be rare that a collective bargaining agreement like this one, where there isn't a statute or a constitutional provision at issue. So here, this is a typical contractual dispute that occurs all the time. The arbitrator had the authority to determine timeliness. His opinion has foundation and reason. The award doesn't conflict with any statutory or constitutional provisions, which will often be the case. So the Court of Appeals erred in vacating the award under those circumstances.
Thank you. Now, what's your conclusion?
In conclusion, the Seventh Circuit's decision in the Clear Channel case is extremely instructive here, because in that case, the court found that arguing that a decision is contrary to plain meaning is another way of arguing that a decision is wrong on the merits, and that is precisely the type of argument that is beyond the court's purview. The court's task is to ensure that the arbitrator is interpreting the contract, not that he's doing so correctly. So we'd ask that the court reverse the Court of Appeals and affirm the circuit court's decision that the arbitrator's decision was reasonable and confirm the award.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Weld, Stephen Weld, representing Baldwin-Woodville Area School District. Counsel?
May it please the court, excuse me. My name is Steve Weld. I practice in Eau Claire. This is my partner, Ryan Steffes, and Andrea Volker, another partner, is in the audience. Both of them worked on this case on behalf of the Baldwin-Woodville School District, a consolidated school district serving K-12 students in central St. Croix County. While the underlying facts and contract interpretation issues are extremely important to the parties in this case and their advocates, we have to ask ourselves, when this case was brought before the Supreme Court, why the court would agree to hear a case which basically is a small claims case. It was less than $2,000 at issue in this case. And then we realized that this is the third of three successful judicial appeals of arbitration decisions in 2008. The other two being the Racine County case that this court decided, and the other being a case involving the Cedarburg School District that the Court of Appeals decided and this court opted not to take jurisdiction on. This is the third case. Obviously, arbitration is expanding. We in the labor area have been doing cases, arbitration cases, for a long time. But as arbitration becomes more prevalent in consumer rights cases, civil rights cases, recently the U.S. Supreme Court expanded the right of contractual grievance procedures to hear discrimination cases, employment cases, business decisions. The realtors filed an amicus brief in this case. Arbitration is expanding. The question for the court is, what is the role of the court, I think, in terms of dealing with these kinds of cases? Counsel has stressed the significance and importance of finality of the arbitration process. We believe equally as important is the integrity of the process. In other words, the arbitration derives his or her power from the collective bargaining agreement, and the decision has to be consistent with the essential terms of that collective bargaining agreement, and we assert that's not the case here. In fact, the success of the three arbitration decisions, the appeals of those arbitration decisions, demonstrate that there is a need for judicial oversight of arbitration decisions. Statutes require that the court considers and monitor and both review arbitration awards and reverse arbitration awards in when the arbitrator exceeds their authority. There are two fact situations or situations, scenarios in which this has occurred. The first is the manifest disregard of the statute, which was addressed in the initial presentation. That's where the decision of the arbitrator is inconsistent with either a statute or the Constitution. And I would contend that Racine County is unique in that it involved constitutional issues, but it is not unique in that the court looked at whether or not the arbitrator's interpretation was consistent with state statutes and this court concluded that it did not. In this case, we contend that the arbitrator perversely misconstrued the collective bargaining agreement. And what is a perverse misconstruction of the agreement? Not just an error of fact or an error of law, but a decision so without basis in the contract that the integrity of the arbitration process is brought to bear. Both the federal cases and the state cases say that the appropriate test of whether an arbitrator perversely misconstrued a contract is whether the award draws the essence from the agreement or is merely an example of the arbitrator's own brand of justice. In other words, the arbitration process is not an equity forum. It's a forum in which the arbitrator is required to interpret the collective bargaining agreement. What are the provisions in the collective bargaining agreement that are issued here? Whether the grievance was presented within 15 days after the facts upon which the grievance is based first became known to the grievant.
Mr. Weld, can I interrupt you for just a minute on this? Your opposing counsel argued that the interpretation by the arbitrator must have a foundation in reason. In other words, that you don't look at whether the interpretation was more reasonable than another interpretation, but whether or not there's a foundation in reason for that interpretation. Do you agree with that principle?
I don't agree that that's what the situation was here, Your Honor. I think the quote that Chief Justice Abrahamson took from the Court of Appeals decision, in which there was no basis under the contract, in other words, the plain and unambiguous language in the contract was not supported or was not in place, and as a result, this isn't a question of interpretation of the contract, but whether the contract justifies or supports the arbitrator's decision. The arbitrator or the Court of Appeal said there's nothing in the contract that allows the arbitrator to come to that conclusion because it's inconsistent with the plain and unambiguous language of the collective bargaining agreement.
You don't think there's any issue of interpretation here, that there's plain language in the collective bargaining agreement?
I believe, Your Honor, that there's only one possible interpretation of the language in terms of the timeliness, and that is that the grievant learned, realized, knew of the improper placement. When she learned of the improper placement on the grid, that's when the grievance properly should have been started. She knew, she learned, she realized that she was improperly placed on the grid at the start of her fourth year of employment. Indeed, the grievance itself, grievance step one, respondent appendix 107, says it was at the beginning of the 2005-2006 school year when Christine learned that the contract was improperly placed. When Christine investigated, she learned that her pay was based on the wrong lane. And as a result, she knew at that point in time, at the start of her fourth year of employment, that she was improperly placed on the grid.
She didn't know she had a dispute with the district until the district said, we're simply not going to pay you what your educational level said you should have been paid, right?
No, she knew she had a dispute on with the grid or with the district when she filed her request for change of placement, and the district responded by moving her but not paying her the back pay.
But they didn't refuse to pay her the back pay. My understanding is that the administrator referred it to the board for a decision on whether she ought to get back pay, right?
Different timeline, Your Honor. Our position is that she knew of the underlying facts when she realized that she was wrongly placed.
Right. Well, she knew she wasn't in. She started out in the correct lane, and then somehow she got shifted. And then she realized the shift, and when she realized the shift, she knew she'd been underpaid for 3 or 4 years period of time, according to what the schedule of payments should have been for her educational level. And then it seems reasonable that she asked to be paid that, but what I'm having trouble with is why she thought the district said no before the board said no. That's where I'm kind of stuck.
Because when she filed her claim for movement on the grid, she was aware of the fact that she had not been paid properly for the 3 years.
But she didn't know the board wasn't just going to give her a check. I mean, I frankly have some trouble understanding why you didn't. I mean, $1,800 you could have paid her, and I bet you spend $7,000 or more getting here. But anyway, that's a policy decision that we don't review, obviously. I mean, why would she think she wouldn't get paid? Why would she think the board would not pay her?
But when did she know she wasn't going to get paid, Your Honor? When she made her request for movement on the grid and she didn't get the money, the back pay, she sat on it. And she sat on it for 8 months. Her obligation under the collective bargaining agreement is to file the grievance within 15 days of when she knew she didn't have the money. And as the grievance initially said, it was back at the start of the 05-06 school year. It was...
You should have assumed the board was going to refuse to pay her at the time she requested for a change in lanes, and they changed the lane, but they didn't send her a check. Is that what...
That's right, Your Honor. Even though it's $2,000 is not a significant amount in the eyes of the court, $2,000 is still $2,000. And so, in September of 2005, when I request the claim, or the movement, and I know I haven't been, was improperly placed for 3 years, that's the trigger. That's when she knows the underlying facts. That's when she has to file her grievance.
So you say as long as she knows facts by which she's disadvantaged, that's the timeline. She doesn't have to wait until the board says, yeah, we see those facts, but we're not going to pay you anything for them. Is that a little...
Didn't pay her the back pay. She had made her request for movement on the grid. She was moved on the grid on a prospective basis. She obviously wasn't getting the money in terms of back pay. She didn't get the money in her first payroll. She didn't get her money in the second payroll. She didn't get her money in the 15th payroll.
Well, let me follow up on that. Your appendix 117. Somebody's appendix 117, the big one. Yours. Is the grievance procedure. This is, I believe, the language of the, well, this is the language from the arbitrator, but I assume that it's the same.
138.
At 138, if we can get that, okay. Yeah, same language. 130, you can look at 138 if you prefer. It's the language of the agreement. The contractual agreement 2005-2007. It says grievances shall be processed in accordance with the following procedure. Step one. An earnest effort shall first be made to settle the matter informally between the teacher and his immediate supervisor. Okay. B. If the matter is not resolved, the grievance shall be presented in writing by the teacher to the immediate supervisor within 15 days after the facts upon which the grievance is based first occur or first become known. Supervisor shall give his written answer within 5 days thereafter. Not settled in step one, grievance may within 5 days be appealed to the superintendent, and it goes on. If step one is in two parts, that you first settle it informally, And you're relying on B, the 15 days, right?
That's correct, Your
Honor. In part two.
Your Honor.
That means you have to file a written, if your interpretation is right, you have to file a written statement to the immediate supervisor of the grievance, even before you make an earnest effort. Because otherwise you're limited to an earnest effort in 15 days, which may be Christmas holiday in the school system. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
I think I do, Your Honor.
What's so plain and unambiguous about that? I mean, even if I accept your argument that if it's plain and unambiguous and there's no question, then the arbitrator is bound by it and we can reverse the arbitrator. What's so plain and unambiguous about step one? Seems to me that there's a real problem in that.
Well, number one, the earnest effort is a communication or a simple conversation. That's taken care of. And in fact, the principal would be the immediate supervisor in this case. But secondly, whether that conversation occurs or not, the employee is obligated under the terms of the contract to file the grievance within 15 days after they become known.
Okay, so the school quits at about whatever the date is, December 15th, takes Christmas recess. The teacher recognizes that she or he's got a problem. No way of informally advising the supervisor who's out of the state. Doesn't leave forwarding addresses. So you're saying that the grievance has to be presented in writing anyway within that 15 days.
Within 15 days, Your Honor, and the parties have indicated that in the next page, Article 7A2, the matter must be processed through the grievance procedure within the prescribed timelines in order for it to be eligible
right.
for finding
A and B do not fit together easily, is what I'm trying to say. Now, I'm not ruling on that, but I think an argument can be made. They don't fit together easily, and your whole argument hinges on, doesn't it hinge on that this is unambiguous and plain? Doesn't your argument fall if this is ambiguous?
I don't believe it's ambiguous, Your
Okay,
Honor.
But does your argument hinge on the concept that this is unambiguous, that you got to do 15 days and it's unambiguous?
That is correct, Your Honor. The 15 days is required by the contract.
Right.
Arbitrators are creatures of contract. Grievance procedure is negotiated by the parties. The parties spend a long time negotiating these types of procedures. Just as the court cannot simply disregard statute of limitations and apply equity, so too the arbitrators are required to follow the grievance procedure and the timelines here.
So your position is it should have been within the 15 days of her receipt of the check?
And no, it should have been within 15 days of the time she requested movement on the grid, because what precipitated the request for movement on the salary grid was her knowledge, her learning, that she had been improperly placed for the 3 years previously.
If she had grieved at that point, wouldn't have been a legitimate response from the district to say, well, the board hasn't decided that yet. There's been no decision by the ultimate decision maker. Wouldn't that have been a perfectly reasonable response to such a grievance?
No, Your Honor, because the grievance procedure goes from the immediate supervisor to the superintendent to the Board of Education. In other words, she has to process her complaint with the supervisor, then with the superintendent, and then with the Board of Education. The grievance must be filed and follow the proper process in the proper timelines, or, as the parties agreed, it's not appropriate to go to arbitration.
I want to ask you about two things. I want to speak to you of practicality, number one, and I want to speak to you about reasonableness vis-a-vis what we have right here, this step one under Article 7, grievance procedure. The Chief Justice asked questions that suggest to me that maybe this isn't all that practical. What if it's over the Christmas holiday season? What, if any, moment is the impracticality of this provision in our review of this case? How important is it that this might not be practical?
I think the requirements in the grievance procedure are set out. They were negotiated by the parties. The parties agreed that we do not count Saturdays and Sundays as days. The parties agreed that we do not count holidays as days. The parties agreed that we would count breaks, summer breaks, as days that count. In other words, the contract is clear that 15 days, as the parties have defined days, is the way the arbitrator has to interpret the contract, and the grievance must be filed within those 15 days.
The second part of my question is reasonableness. And when your opposing counsel was making argument, one of the arguments advanced is, hey, look, it isn't reasonable to have unions or anyone file a grievance before they really know what the answer is going to be. Sounds like a pretty good argument. You know, I mean, in some circumstances, given this timetable set forth in step one, the grievant may be in a situation where the grievant is presenting in writing to the teacher or employee representative, to the immediate supervisor, to the immediate supervisor within 15 days after the facts upon which the grievance is based first occur or first become known. Now, maybe it's not all that reasonable in certain situations because they haven't haven't yet decided if they're going to pay. Of what import is the reasonableness in our review of this?
I don't think it has any role at all, Your Honor. I believe the arbitrator's role is to interpret the contract. The contract says these are the things we've got to do. In other words, what would happen if the arbitrator would say, I know it says 15 days, but I'm just going to disregard that. Or I don't think 15 days is reasonable. I'm going to interpret that as 15 weeks. Or 15 pay periods, or 15 months. Or under that theory, or the theory that counsel's espoused here, the grievance doesn't even start until the employee raises the complaint regarding the back pay and moves ahead. That means that had she not raised the issue in May or June of 2006, it's still a viable grievance. In other words, the decision was made at the start of the 05-06 school year to move the grievance on the salary schedule and not to provide back pay. She knew that at the start of the 05-06 school year. Had she not raised the grievance at the end of that school year, 270 days later, under counsel's theory, she could raise it now. It's still a viable grievance. Even though the action took place at the start of the 05 school year, even though the contract says 15 days, arguably, it's still a viable grievance. She could wait till the end of her career in the district, 15 years from now, and say, by the way, my pay for 2002 through 2005 was inaccurate. You owe me money for that. And under that theory, under your theory, it would be a reasonable interpretation and allowable for her to do that. The contract says within 15 days. Is that a reasonable timeline? I don't know. That's what the parties agreed to.
I'm not into the reasonableness. I'm into the plain language. It says, an earnest effort shall first be made to settle the matter. What if they had made no effort to settle the matter informally between the teacher and the immediate supervisor?
The teacher came to the district at the start of the 05-06 school year and said, I was improperly paid for the last 3 years. You are paying me improperly now. The district said, you're right. We are going to move you on the grid to your proper placement on the grid. But we're not going to do anything about the back pay. That's the trigger for the grievance.
How did they tell her we're not going to do anything about the back pay?
They didn't take the action. They simply said, or did, the movement. Moved her on the grid. She was aware that she had not been properly placed. She was aware she had not been properly placed for 3 years. She was aware that they owed her money. At that point, the district says, we're moving you on the grid. At that point, it's her job to say, where's my backpack? She never asked that question. She never asked that question until 270 days later.
How long did it take to get her salary increased for prospectively?
The next payroll.
And how long did that take?
Bi-monthly payroll or every other week payroll.
Is there any possibility that she could have just been waiting for a while to see for them to cut that special check?
Why doesn't she go to the district and say, where's the money? That's the trigger for the back pay. She needs to do, as the chief indicated, she needs to raise the question.
So from the day that she requested an adjustment in the schedule and back pay, how long passed before she did something else?
270 days.
She didn't go to the principal.
She did nothing.
But 270 days?
Excuse me?
She didn't go to the principal or the superintendent or anybody for 270 days?
When did she first ask for back pay?
At the end of the...
For back pay, not for the adjustment.
At the end of the 05-06 school year. 270 days after she had first said, you folks are placing me incorrectly, place me correctly, and I need the money.
Now, the arbitrator concluded, and I'm reading from the Court of Appeals, that the fact upon which the grievance was based was the school board's denial of Johnson's request for back pay in late June 2006. What happened in June 2006?
At the end of the school year, the grievant went to the superintendent and said, where's my back pay? Okay. 270 days after she had been moved on the grid. The superintendent at that point said, the board's made the decision not to give you back pay. I've got to go to them to see if they're going to change their mind.
Now, before that she had asked, but no one said anything to her, and they merely did it prospectively, right?
She filed a request for movement on the grid. The district said, you're right, you've proven that you have earned the credits, the postgraduate credits, and they moved her on the grid at that point.
Okay. But no one said you're not getting back pay.
It seems to me implicit, Your Honor, that if you say, I know I was improperly placed, I know I was improperly placed for 3 years, it's incumbent on the employee to say, where's my back pay?
You see, the problem that we're discussing here is whether B, sub B in that provision, is clear and unambiguous or not. And the arbitrator thought it was not clear and unambiguous. And the arbitrator said, the first words, if the matter is not resolved, to the arbitrator it was not resolved because the board never said no. And then he says, how do you make sense out of B when it starts, if the matter is not resolved, and it ends up within 15 days of after the facts upon which the grievance is based? So it seems to me the arbitrator is saying, hey, 15 days can't be from the date that the grievant really knew that there was a problem, that the 15 days and when the grievant really knows there's a problem is when the matter is not resolved, and that the 15 days is in conflict, the latter part of the language is in conflict with the first part of the sentence. I mean, that's the ambiguity that is possible. Now, if we are going to debate that, if we're going to debate it, then it seems to me the answer is that the arbitrator had leeway. I think your response is it's not debatable. It's clear as mud, right?
It's clear, Your Honor.
Right. That's a very good response to me. It's clear. That's right. And then it's not debatable. So we have to decide, is it debatable? I mean, I don't know that this is the legal issue, but at least it's one legal issue. Whether it's debatable what that B means when you look at it internally, just if the matter is resolved, and then the last part. And further, if it's clear when you look at it externally for A. Isn't that the issue that you're presenting to us? It's not a trick question.
I believe it is clear on the record that this grievant knew that she wasn't properly paid and had not been properly paid. It's in the grievance itself, and it's in the arbitrator's decision where he cites from our brief and says the grievant knew and testified that she knew she had been improperly placed for the 3 years.
And so the arbitrator had a totally unreasonable interpretation.
I believe that that's correct, Your Honor. Yeah. Obviously, an employee who's short of $2,000 knows they're short of $2,000 when they make the request for movement on the grid. And they have an obligation within 15 days of when they know, by contract, to file the grievance at that time. This grievance failed to do that. As a result, the arbitrator was without jurisdiction. And that's what the Court of Appeals concluded. The plain and unambiguous language was that the grievance had to be filed within 15 days of when the grievant knew of the problem or of the concern or of the shortage, and they didn't do that. This is not a question of ambiguous language that is being interpreted by the arbitrator. This is a situation where the essence of the collective bargaining agreement says you have to file your grievance within the 15 days of when you knew the grievance of the underlying issues.
How did the teacher communicate with the district about being shorted in pay?
There's a document in the respondent's transcript, Your Honor. It's the request for movement on the grid.
In writing?
Yes.
Is that a grievance?
Not a grievance. No, it was not. It would be arguable that that was the informal communication under in which the issue was raised to the district.
Well, why wouldn't that be any complaint regarding the interpretation or application of a specific provision of this agreement?
It would be a complaint, but it about the back pay at that point. In other words, the grievance said you improperly placed me. I am aware that you have improperly placed me for 3 years. I want to be moved. I am moved. Obviously, she knows at that point in time that there's a problem regarding the back pay. She does not file a grievance within the 15 days after the district responded to her complaint or her inquiry. Our position is the very latest that this could have happened, or that the grievance knew, was at the first payroll or the second payroll, in which she obviously didn't get the money.
That request was made not to the immediate supervisor, but to the board. The request was
made to the district office, Your Honor, okay. And was responded to affirmatively, because the employee then provided the documentation of the postgraduate credits, which had not been previously provided.
Ms. Jolman, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
First, I would just like to clarify the record in this case. Mr. Weld is distorting the factual record. The court must accept the arbitrator's factual findings. Mr. Weld is saying that she knew on this date and she knew on this date. It was for the arbitrator to determine when she knew. That's a factual question, a question of credibility. The arbitrator heard her testify, examined the evidence, and determined that the first point that she knew the employer's position regarding back pay was when she found out about the board's vote. Now, he wants to say she found out in August, she found out in May. There's no citation to the record that the district ever informed her of its position regarding back pay prior to the board vote.
Now, what date was that?
That the district did not offer that date into the record, but she testified she learned of the vote in June 2006. So the arbitrator found, because the district had the burden of proof, that they didn't show that she found out more than 15 days after the grievance was filed.
Well, let me see here. As I understand the facts, sometime in August or thereabouts, 2005, submits a document saying, I am being paid inadequately. And the district responds affirmatively about prospective payments, but doesn't do so retroactively. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. And then I think your opposing counsel is representing that 270 days passed before she did anything else. Is that right?
I don't know where he gets that, because the date that they met with the district administrator is also not in the record. It says May 2006, but the exact date is not there. But in August, she did ask to be replaced on the correct lane. The district did so, but there was nothing communicated to her at that time that said, we're not giving you back pay. And that's shown by the district administrator himself, because when she goes to talk to him about it, he defers that to the board. If the district had already decided we're not giving you back pay, he would have just told her that at that time, but he doesn't.
When did she ask for back pay? When is this communication to the district?
In May 2006, the grievance documents indicate that she thought it was an administrative error, so she goes to talk to the district administrator about it. And the arbitrator found that the district administrator found he did not have the authority to make the requested payment, so he deferred the decision to the board. But what's troubling about this is that we're here talking about the facts of the case, and really what the district is trying to do is to say he doesn't like what the arbitrator found, and I understand that. But he's asking the court to become the arbitrator and make a different interpretation.
But Ms. Jonan, didn't the Court of Appeals find that based on the arbitrator's findings, the latest possible point at which the fact of her non-payment was known to Ms. Johnson was she realized in May 2006.
Yes.
And that's the court interpreting the arbitrator's findings.
Yes, but the Court of Appeals erred when they did so, because the arbitrator construed the ambiguous language to be that the complaint was the board's denial of back pay, not when she went to talk to the administrator about the back pay. The complaint occurred when the board voted to deny the back pay in June, and it was that complaint that is the grievance. And so, as the Chief Justice has recognized, the grievance procedure has ambiguous language, and language is ambiguous when it is subject to more than one interpretation. Here, the language is subject to more than one interpretation because the Court of Appeals interpreted it one way, the arbitrator interpreted it another. But it was within the arbitrator's authority to interpret that ambiguous language. And the arbitrator looked at everything and determined that in June 2006 was the first time that it was communicated to Ms. Johnson and the union that the board was denying the back pay. The association filed its grievance within the 15-day timeline provided by the contract. And under Winkleman versus Kraft, the arbitrator doesn't have to have the most reasonable interpretation. It just has to have a foundation in reason. Here, the arbitrator's decision does so. So the question is, did the arbitrator exceed his authority in construing this ambiguous language? The arbitrator did not. Even if the court found that its interpretation is a better one, or disagreed with the arbitrator's finding of fact and thought he made an error of fact or even an error of law, it should not vacate the award. Because if the court vacates the award in this case, then it will encourage parties who don't like the arbitrator's decision, like the district, to take their case to court and ask the court to reach a more favorable decision. This court has long instructed that it's not the court's role. I see that my time has expired. May I briefly conclude?
Complete the sentence quickly.
The court's role is merely supervisory in nature to see that the parties receive what they bargained for, and they did in this case. Thank you.
Thank you both to Attorney Jonan and Attorney Weld for their excellent arguments today relating to judicial review of arbitration awards, always a difficult issue for the court. That concludes our argument in 08-18519, Baldwin-Woodville Area School District versus West Central Education Association. The court is in recess until 1:30 when it will hear its third case for today. Are those students and others who wish to remain for the discussion with Justice Ziegler should do so, and if counsel would approach the bench, please.